From the Sky News Centre at 5, FIFA president Sepp Blatter is the subject of criminal proceedings by authorities in Switzerland. He's suspected of making a disloyal payment to UEFA chief Michel Platini and also of criminal mismanagement or misappropriation over a TV rights deal signed in 2005. Former Sports Minister Richard Caborn says the allegations surrounding Platini is significant, bearing in mind he's in the running to succeed Blatter.
This needs to be cleared up ASAP. The person that can do that, obviously Michel Platini himself, by saying that payment was made, but it was quite legitimate, and put that into the public domain. Now the allegation is in the public domain.
The government's announced the last British national left at Guantanamo Bay is being released back to the UK. It follows a long campaign for Shaka Armour's transfer home. He's been held at the maximum security prison camp in Cuba for 13 years, despite not going on trial. His lawyer, Corey Kreider, has given the news a cautious welcome.
What we need to know now is just how certain this is. Shaka's wife and his four children have had their hopes dashed so many times. I hope this is a positive development, but we need more detail.
Families of dozens of Muslims from South Wales taking part in the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia saying they're urgently trying to contact them. They've not heard from them since the huge crush there yesterday, which killed more than 700 people. A 19-year-old man starting a minimum of 8 years in prison for a plot to commit mass murder at Newcastle College. Liam Liebird was found with pipe bombs and a gun before he could carry out the attack. UKIP's leader claims the election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader will see its traditional supporter switch allegiance. Nigel Farage has been speaking at the party's conference in Doncaster. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news is former Eastfield councillor, leader of the Lib Dem group, at one time on Bristol City Council, Steve Comer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, 17,000 victims of terrorism in Iran since the 1979 revolution. We hear from the wife of one of them this evening. Her physicist professor husband was killed 5 years ago on his morning drive to work by a bomb detonated by remote control just as the car was passing. Plus the strange case of Raymond Davis, the US defence contractor in Lahore, Pakistan, who got suspicious that two men were following him. So he turned around and shot them dead. Obama said he was a US diplomat. But after Pakistan police arrested him on his phone, it became clear he was in touch with the terror groups in Afghanistan and Pakistan, supplying them with weaponry. So just what is the role of private defence contractors? Where do they get their orders? And why do we hear so little about them? We speak to Professor of International Relations at the University of Peshawar, Saeed Shaheed. Plus it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 18, sunnier on Saturday, sunny spells on Sunday. Next week, that's highs of 18 degrees Celsius, plenty of sunshine. Next weekend, 2nd and 3rd of October, highs of 16 degrees Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is former Eastfield councillor, leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, Steve Comer. Hi, Steve, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Now, you're not the leader of the Lib Dem group now. I don't want to confuse anybody, but you were at once. Take us back to the days when you were, Steve. When was this?
Well, heady days back in 2007. We had a Liberal Democrat minority administration at the time. We were the largest party on the council, and I stood for the leadership and replaced Barbara Jank, and she returned the compliment the following year.
So you were give us an idea of the difference between the way it works now with the mayor and you as the leader of the council.
Well, I was never leader of the council because the Tory group put to put Labour in power. Obviously, as I said, there was no overall control. Liberal Democrats were, at that stage, the largest party. What happened then was you had the leader in cabinet system, which had been introduced by the Blair government in 2000. Prior to that, councils had run by committees with, subject-based committees with a committee chair. That had worked for many decades. That was changed by the Blair government, who wanted more emphasis on the executive role, and introduced a system where you could have two variants. One was a mayor, elected mayor, which some councils took up at the time, not many, but a few did. And the other one was leader in cabinet, which was almost universal in councils over a certain size, and Bristol followed that example. So you had a little bit like in Parliament, you had a division between front and back benchers in terms of councillors for the first time. I was a cabinet member for 2 years for resources, human resources, finance and so on. I think there were 8 in the cabinet at the time, and a leader of council. So that's how it worked, and that's how it worked right up until the mayoral system came in.
Were you a bit annoyed though, because you'd been leader of the party and you won some electoral success? Once it looked like the Liberal Democrats were going to be running the council, suddenly you're shunted sideways.
Well, these things happen in politics, and you know, as I say, with no overall control, you're never quite sure where things are going to go. We had been in the administration, and as I say, been running that minority since 2005. I think there was a certain amount of mischief making with the Conservative group at the time. I think they wanted to kick the Liberal Democrats out, and then a few months later offered to put us back in again.
So
stage we said no thanks.
You're painting a picture of the Tory group, even though it's a minority group, as the sort of kingmakers of the city.
I think that's how they saw themselves at the time. I think it's slightly different now, but I think at the time that's how they saw themselves, and that was the position we were in. I never say the group had had some electoral success. We got to 32 and then 33 councillors. 2008 was a year with no council elections in Bristol, and so the next set of elections were the year after. So I never actually had the privilege of leading the group into a set of elections, which I would have liked to have done.
What about the Liberal Democrats now, though, Steve? Because you, as part of the disenchantment with the Lib Dems nationally, are now no longer a councillor, and I understand you're actually giving up on Bristol. You're leaving the city.
I'm leaving the city. Yes. Long-term ambition. My wife and I have had to. To move to Cyprus, and we always thought we would do it when our occupational pensions came in. They come in next year, so we're going a little bit earlier than we originally planned. And we're looking forward to a change and a new life.
Well, looking back on the city, if you want, like, to leave us any kind of hints and tips about what you've learnt, I suppose, as part of the constellation at the top of politics in the city, managing what effectively, certainly the way I see it, Steve, I don't know about you, is that there's all this public money that we have to pay or we go to jail, and it's you folks' job to spend it, which is around about £1,000 per person in the city, something like that anyway. So what's your take from your experience at the top of politics at sometimes anyway in the city?
I think we still see far too much intervention from national government. We're still far too centralised as a country, and I would like to see us having more resources to spend locally and having more accountability as to how we did it. When I came into cabinet, I was quite surprised by the number of funds that were ring fenced from central government. You know, they would give local government a task to do, provide resource, and then ring fence the money, so you couldn't make local decisions based on local needs. A former councillor colleague of mine said that he went to Seville in the early 2000s, and they were talking about a tram system, and he went back there 5 years later and they built it. They went to they had a bond issue, they took some from their equivalent of council tax, and they got it done. Here, far too much emphasis on the whole bidding process, which I think is just a massive job creation scheme for lawyers and accountants.
One of the things which is being decided, it looks like, by central government, is the decision about whether to keep or not to keep the Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Nick Gargan. Apparently today we're supposed to hear, although there's been no news so far, which is pretty much close of play now, that Tom Windsor is the from Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary is going to give his view on the case of suspended Chief Constable Nick Gargan by close of play today, apparently, but we still haven't seen any news of that. What are your thoughts about this whole debacle in the context, I suppose, of this new role of the Police and Crime Commissioner?
I think the problem is you're not sure what the background to it is, because not much has come out in the public domain.
Well, it's been a bit more this week, hasn't there?
I mean, yeah, there is, yeah.
For example, in the Bristol Post, an insider said Mr. Gargan gained enemies at the force when he apologised to retired school teacher Christopher Jeffries for not making it clear sooner that he was innocent. This is in an article a couple of days ago, a headline, Bristol Police Chief Nick Gargan determined to keep his job and has the strength to fight back. Also says this source, Mr. Gargan was keen on transparency, social media and modernising and changing the force. The process of asking him to resign has been started not for his misconduct, but because there's not enough public confidence in him, and yet that's not his fault, they say. I mean, this whole thing is really predicated on this idea that there is not enough public or police confidence in the guy, and yet that's just really the opinion of the Police and Crime Commissioner. As we discussed on this programme last week, the Police and Crime Commissioner's husband is actually the chairman also of Business West, who are a quite important lobby in themselves, Steve.
Well, that's right, and that... I wasn't aware of that, and certainly that has echoes of a former chief constable, Colin Port, whose wife was also involved in business and part of an operation called Southwest One, which was set up to do support services for both the police and Somerset County Council. I mean, I think with this one, you know, I had a long time as a trade union official before I was a councillor, and I know the difference between gross misconduct and misconduct, and it's a huge difference, not just one word. It was alleged that Nick Gargan was guilty of gross misconduct. The inquiry was held, went on for months. It was found that there was no case to answer on gross misconduct, but there was misconduct. Now, the problem you've got, it's all very well a police and crime commissioner or even a panel or a police authority in the old days saying that, well, we think you should go, old boy. But, I mean, in the case of Nick Gargan, he's 48. So obviously he's going to fight to maintain his job, particularly if he feels that there, you know, whilst he may have done some wrong, he hasn't done enough wrong to justify being forced out.
Yeah, it's basically emails, apparently, and then some of the contents of some of these have leaked out this week. One email he sent said, thank you once again for Friday, and it's a woman, possibly a female officer. Thank you once again for Friday. You looked beautiful. We're the perfect plus one, and you were fantastic company. I hope we get to repeat it sometime. Also saying to another female colleague, asking her out for a glass of wine. And also the Independent Police Complaints Commission said Mr. Gargan had blurred the boundaries between his work and his personal life, but admitted some of the women described themselves as flattered by his attention. Now, this is misconduct. So apparently, actually, it's the other charges which are misconduct, to do with forwarding emails to people supposedly inappropriately. What bothers me most about this, Steve, is that the things he was originally charged with, they've been found to be baseless. What's happened is, because of those initial allegations, basically a phishing operation took place where the investigators have found several other things which are minor. So it does seem like this is really just an example of the worst kind of police practice you'll find anywhere in the country, indeed anywhere in the world, where the police go in with a trumped-up charge to trawl through someone's belongings, their communications, letters, etc., trying to find something else on them. And that's what this sounds like, and it's happening to the chief constable himself.
He came in, Gargan. I quite liked him. I thought he was a good profile. You know, a bit of a breath of fresh air, and maybe that's what was not welcome within the force. I mean, it's the sort of occupation, I mean, I worked in the customs for years, and it's similar. It's the sort of occupation where people work there for many years, and often they don't like change coming in. And if Nick Gargan represented change, then I could see that there, quite easily, how there could be internal resistance and a dislike of changes he wanted to make.
Well, after Nick Gargan was appointed in March 2013, one clash of the titans that allegedly took place at Avon and Somerset Police Headquarters was with Emma Zimmern. As Director of Human Resources, she was arguably the most powerful kingmaker within the force, making recommendations as to who would or would not get promotion. She's alleged to have said, "I'm going to take Nick Gargan down when I go." So was Emma Zimmern one of the two women who made allegations against Nick Gargan, not as a victim herself, but on behalf of other staff, of inappropriate conduct which might have been found to be unprovable or false? Well, we don't know that. We still don't know. But what about this, the former chief constable? This is quite interesting what you're saying about South West One, because I think we covered it at the time, actually, briefly. And also there was a raid on an expert witness in child pornography cases that nearly got the former chief constable, Colin Port, sent to jail. He had High Court bailiffs knocking on his door because it was a totally inappropriate use of his detectives in a different part of the country to arrest someone who was completely innocent and take all their computer equipment. So one wonders whether, what exactly was going on with the former chief constable and his wife. We call her Mrs. Port. We like to call her Mrs. Port, even though that wasn't actually her surname. It was, I think, Sue Barnes, wasn't it? Again, a little bit like Sue Mount Stevens with, I think it's Robertson. Her husband's name is a different surname. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but it does tend to obscure the fact that they're actually, you know, quite connected. So what happened here at Bristol City Council with that same South West One? Because I know they attempted to convince several local authorities to get their support services privatised into the hands of the former chief constable's wife.
Yeah, I think that there was definitely attempts to, when I was cabinet member, you know, there were approaches being made that would Bristol like to do this. I said no. Officers weren't keen. I suppose that made me look at it, because you think if officers aren't keen, what are they defending? But I looked at it and thought that the business case didn't really stack up. A successor of mine in the same role also had a look at it when they were doing some rationalisation of back office functions. He decided it wasn't worth looking at all. South West One, I think, was the brainchild of a former chief executive of Somerset County Council, and I think he felt that he would get lots of other authorities to come in, and he had a famous row with his opposite number in Exeter, in Devon County Council, because he thought, well, you've let us down by not backing this project. And he said, you don't think I'm going to sack people in Exeter so the jobs can be moved up the road to Taunton? And so I think, I mean, in the end, the whole South West One project collapsed, and the Somerset County at least took the work back in house again. I imagine Avon and Somerset would have done the same. So clearly it was a flawed model, otherwise it would still be with us.
There are several these sorts of networks or business networks that Sue Mount Stevens' husband's part of. There's a local enterprise partnership, Business West, which he chairs. There's things like the Institute of Directors, the Chambers of Commerce, and of course the good old Merchant Venturers. What do you make of these business groups' influence on the city, Steve?
I think it's probably increased, and I think it's probably increased because of the mayoral system. Because I think some of these people were lobbyists for that system. You've got executive power. I mean, we spoke earlier about executive power in the local authority being in the hands of a leader in cabinet. Well, the mayoral system took it one stage further, and all the executive power is now vested in one individual. And it's one individual who's had quite a long association with, amongst others, the Merchant Venturers. I mean, I suppose Bristol's not unlike most cities in that there is a there is quite a strong lobby of what you might call, I used to call them TGAG, you know, the great and the good. And I don't think we're any different to lots of other places in that regard. But it certainly is long-lasting. And as you say, the merchant adventurers goes back hundreds of years, which, you know, the average Chamber of Commerce or Business West type organisation is usually more recent.
Well, also, yeah, I mean, it goes back a long way to the 1400s. Actually, the merchant adventurers themselves don't, but the Bristol merchants do. And, of course, yeah, they were involved in the financing the trip to where America was discovered, even though it had already been discovered by quite a lot of millions of Native Americans beforehand, which I find a bit of an irritating term, so I shouldn't really use that. But I mean, obviously, it's used generally, even teaching kids still, we discovered America, this kind of thing. The merchant venturers seem to be at the heart of a lot of this, because you'll find quite a lot of them on these various groups, as I was saying, Institute of Directors, Business West, the Local Enterprise Partnership. They are appointed, I understand, apart from the council leaders, by these business bodies. So let's have a listen now back to the mid-1990s, late 1990s, to the old days when HTV used to make documentaries. And here's James Garrett's little extract from his documentary he made at the time, which you can view online, all about the merchant venturers.
We've nothing to hide. We're not a secret society. We're working as an organisation with the best endeavours of a community at heart.
This table has been laid for one of the grandest and most exclusive banquets to be held in Bristol this year. Most people didn't even know it was happening. It's the annual audit dinner of the Society of Merchant Venturers, probably the most influential people in the city. This is the first film ever to be made about a previously secretive organisation which has played a leading role in the city's affairs since the Middle Ages.
The Society of Merchant Venturers began as the corporate voice of the traders who made Bristol the country's second biggest port. Its members profited from the slave trade and earlier had financed the voyage which led to the colonisation of North America. For centuries, the Society ran the port on behalf of the City Council, becoming wealthy through the taxing of ships and goods. When this privilege ended in the 19th century, and along with it the importance of Bristol as a port, the merchants might have collapsed, as did similar groups elsewhere in Britain. They didn't. To this day, Bristol's biggest companies have a significant factor in common. Half the 8 board members at the Bristol and West, the 10th largest building society, are merchant venturers, including Christopher Thomas, President Sir John Wills, and Chief Executive John Burke. Mr. Thomas and Sir John are also directors of the Bristol Waterworks Company, a million customers across the West. In addition, Sir John is Deputy Chairman of the Bristol Evening Post Company, publisher of the West's biggest-selling local newspaper. Bristol's other major employers, like DRG, Imperial Tobacco and the Bristol Aeroplane Company, also drew many of their directors from the same small pool while they were locally owned. These prominent businessmen also play a leading role in the city's social, educational and political life. Many are even related to each other. Perhaps it's no surprise that the merchant venturers are referred to, albeit jokingly, as the Bristol Mafia.
Well, that's an extract from James Garrett's HTV documentary back in the late 1990s about the merchant ventures. It's one of the West Eye View programmes. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Steve's hinting there that actually some of these business elites are even more powerful under the mayoral system, what with the mayor being a former merchant venturer, than they were beforehand.
Well, as Adam Smith said in The Wealth of Nations, when business people get together, even on social occasions, it's usual for conspiracies against the public to be enacted. And I think that it's oligarchy is the bane of our society. It has been for many generations, and in many ways we're a more oligarchic society now than we were maybe 50.
What is an oligarchy?
Oligarchy means ruled by the few, usually by the wealthy. And in actual fact, there's been studies done in the US by Harvard University, I think it is, that claim fairly convincingly to my mind that the United States isn't a democracy, it's effectively an oligarchy. And I think that is actually pretty much the truth about the kind of society we live in. There's a democratic facade, there are elections of a sort, not necessarily entirely, the electoral system is certainly rigged, I think Steve and I would agree about that. But the fact is that behind the scenes, the real string pullers continue to pull strings, and in actual fact have probably got more powerful in the last 20-30 years than they were previously.
Well, I mean, you're saying elections are rigged?
Not rigged. The electoral system is wrong. It doesn't actually allow the full expression of views. But that's not the real issue. The real issue that the City of London can destroy a government, and frequently have tried to do so. And the merchant venturers are the local version of that oligarchic power. And there've been some reforms of British society that took place in my childhood and before, but that's been clawed back pretty dramatically by the wealthy classes since then, and they pretty much run the show behind the facade of democracy. I think that's pretty obvious to anybody who looks at it objectively.
Steve Comer, former leader of the Lib Dems, do you agree with Martin about the idea of the electoral system being rigged?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, first past the post is a terrible electoral system. I mean, we had, 35% of the electorate that voted Conservative, and yet they have a majority in Parliament. Well, clearly that is unrepresentative, and reform is long overdue. I think the attempt to get a partial reform was misjudged and mistimed during the last Parliament. But certainly, I think if you look at the examples of Scotland and Wales, I think they are better governed through having a more proportional system, as are most of the most EU countries. Generally, they are better governed than we are.
Martin, you mentioned a few weeks ago, didn't you, your thoughts about the idea of actually trying to dissuade people from even registering to vote. That's happening more and more, isn't it?
Well, what worries me is that the Conservatives have made no secret that they intend to redraw the electoral boundaries. They're going to reduce the number of MPs, so that gives them an excuse to redraw the electoral boundaries. This used to be dealt with by the Boundary Commission, which is in theory an objective referee. And then they're going to redraw it on the basis of the existing electoral registers. Now, we know, for example, in Bristol West, where we are now, and I think the same is true across Bristol and across the country, that less people were registered to vote at this election than in the previous election in 2010. If it was 2010 when we had the last election, I can't remember now. And that is because of individual registration. And I think it's actually this is imported from the United States of America. A large proportion of the electorate in the United States of America isn't registered to vote, and in actual fact, that is part of strategy for electoral spin doctors in the US. They don't, in fact, want poor people to register. So if you remember back to the 1960s, one of the big struggles of the civil rights movement was to get black people on the electoral register. They were in principle allowed to vote, but in actual practice, they weren't registered.
I mean, Martin, this was happening in Northern Ireland as well. Indeed, contributed to the Troubles.
Then contributed to the run-up to the Troubles. But we're now moving very rapidly, I think. The Tories, I think this will be interesting, because we've got, in 5 years' time, we will have an election under the current electoral system, with the boundaries changed, and probably an electorate very much denuded. In actual fact, it's the inner city areas which tend to be underrepresented, and of course that's pretty bad at the best of times. But if you're going to redraw the electoral boundaries on the basis of those corrupt registers, then it really does start to look like gerrymandering of the sort that we saw in Northern Ireland before 1969, and I think this is going to be a big issue.
And I think the whole idea of political interference in boundaries, I mean, you see that, the whole word gerrymander comes from Eugene Gerry, who was an American state governor, who redrew boundaries, and they said, well, this one looks like a salamander. And if you look at some of the American districts for the House of Representatives, they're very peculiar shapes, because they are drawn by, the winning party draws it in a form that is to its advantage. So the whole idea of natural communities or anything goes out the window, and so you end up in many states with seats that are very solidly Democratic or very solidly Republican, and a relatively small number that are marginal, and how that balance goes depends on who is running the show at the time. And I think that is really dangerous. I actually support the idea of reducing the number of MPs, because I think we need to devolve power away from Westminster, and one way to do that is to have less MPs and they can concentrate on major issues rather than being sort of alternative councillors, which is a lot of their casework and so on, is actually at the moment. I think individual electoral registration is the right policy, but it's been introduced too quickly. And Liberal Democrats and Labour MPs have said that, you know, we need a longer transition. We need a longer time of what they call a rollover, where people have been on the register and they haven't communicated and they're automatically put back on. I think we need more time to adjust to the system. But, you know, individual registration came in Northern Ireland initially, and I think it is the right policy. But, you know, even with the right policy, you've got to take time to implement it properly.
But the council tax is effectively just the same as the poll tax was going to be, wasn't it? So people are avoiding registering to vote because they're worried that they'll be hit by council tax.
Don't think it works that way, because you end up with this issue, because council tax is on buildings. You end up with a joint and several liability issue where if there's six people in a house and only two are registered, but the council have the names of one of those two, then they can go after them for the bill. And when I was a councillor, I met this problem a couple of times where people have been left with a big council tax bill because they were in a shared household and the other parties to the shared household had moved on or left no forwarding address, but the council could get hold of one party who either hadn't moved on or who they knew where they were, and they'd go after them for the
actually,
money.
You're almost making my point for me, because it's almost like you were saying, well, best thing is just not to register and hopefully dodge out of the way before the council tax people get after you. But anyway, I want to talk about another aspect of electoral fraud now, and that is to do with postal votes. And earlier this week I spoke to a former civil servant press officer and journalist at The Voice magazine, Simon Hines, about his concerns about postal voting fraud.
I'm Simon Hines. I'm from North London. I've been active in the Labour Party, and I do have concerns about the general election that I think people are missing. Like a lot of people, I thought that Miliband would come out as the Prime Minister, not necessarily as having the overall majority, but as a Prime Minister, perhaps with some sort of arrangement with the SNP. When the Conservatives came out as being the largest party, I was surprised and a bit suspicious, so I began to look into it. I noticed stories in local papers talking about postal votes, some postal votes going missing, and ballot boxes turning up late. So in Milton Keynes, for instance, a couple of ballot boxes turned up after the vote had been announced. So something strange going on with votes and with postal votes. There was concern around 200,000 postal votes going missing in south part of England. And a woman from the constituency was saying this would definitely be a Labour seat, but it was actually won by a Conservative. That was in the same seat that's relevant to the 200,000 ballots going missing.
How secure do you think the whole process of postal voting is then?
Well, there's concern that's been acknowledged by the Electoral Commission that postal votes isn't necessarily secure at all and could be subject to manipulation. There certainly has been cases of postal vote fraud going on a local basis, and we've seen that in Tower Hamlets. I think that it was going on a national basis as well.
What's the evidence that's come out of Tower Hamlets then?
Eric Pickles, who was the Communities Minister, sent someone in to look at Tower Hamlets, and the then mayor, who was Mr. Raman, was an independent, was actually removed from his post because of allegations around postal voter fraud and other types of fraud. And it was, I think, Labour Party members who actually complained about him. It's been acknowledged that there was significant postal vote fraud in the local elections around Tower Hamlets.
What about the difference between the polls before the general election and what happened afterwards?
The polls seem to have got it all wrong. Before the election, polls were saying that Labour and Tory were neck and neck. None of the polls actually got it right. We had the post-election poll that the BBC had. They came out with a shock result saying that the Conservatives would win. They were right about that, but actually wrong about the number of seats that the Tories actually gained. So none of the polls got it right. There's still anomalies around the actual result, and people are still puzzled about it. There was a notion of shy Tories and late swing voters that were used to explain the Conservative win. Ipsos Mori has looked into this, and there's two reports that they've written that concludes that they can't find the shy Tories, that there weren't any late swing voters, and there was voter fraud that wasn't in the interest of the Labour Party. So this is their own research that's shown this. And since the election, the PM, David Cameron, has given the former minister, Eric Pickles, a job to look into postal votes. And he's repeated the issue around Tower Hamlets, but also said he feared that a Tower Hamlets type fraud had actually gone on during the general election. And he said he's spoken to local authority chief executives who also have serious issues with the postal vote.
The key to any general election is the marginals. What do we know about what happened there?
According to Conservative Home, they did a number of articles in the run-up to the election. Some of the polling results there in March showed that the Labour Party was ahead, around 5% in the marginals, and that they were better organised in the marginals. Another publication, Labour List, said they had some inside information as to why it was that Ed Miliband made that rushed meeting with Russell Brand, presumably to cook up some votes amongst the young for the Labour Party. What Labour List wrote was that Ed Miliband had seen sight of some of the postal vote results, were quite surprised that the Conservatives were ahead, and went to Russell Brand to attempt to mobilise Labour votes to counteract this Tory advantage in the postal vote. What analysis I have seen is that the Conservative vote didn't go up very much. I think it went up about 1.4%. The Labour vote went up a lot more, 3.6, I think. But most of the increase of the Labour vote was in the marginals. And so I suspect that most of this vote was the postal vote. And that the postal vote could have been a reason as to why a lot of the opinion polls got it wrong. They perhaps hadn't included the postal vote adequately. So my conclusion is that the Conservatives won because of the postal vote, and there looked to be some degree of fraud going on in the postal vote.
I mean, isn't it possible that the Conservatives just quietly spent quite a lot of time and effort in making sure that everyone that could do a postal vote, maybe if they're even resident abroad during the time of the election, that they use that vote? And that's actually not fraud, is it?
That could be the case. I haven't heard that, and certainly the stuff I've read on the Conservatives' political home suggests that Labour Party was more organised in the marginals than they were. They were quite worried about it. So, yes, it could be the case that the Conservatives managed to organise themselves around the postal vote, but I haven't come across any evidence to suggest that's the case.
Yeah, let's move on and talk about Mr Corbyn, because I wonder what you made of the reaction particularly by the media to Jeremy Corbyn being made Labour leader.
What was quite surprising is what a surprise it was that Corbyn won. And I think for powerful people in the UK, this hadn't been on the cards. And I would imagine they think they probably won't be able to control Corbyn in the way they could control others as Labour leaders. That's partly what they fear. They also fear that Corbyn will mobilise a lot of people who are getting angry around the neoliberal economic agenda. And the Conservatives will be taking more and more decisions that will annoy more and more people. So there's crisis in the NHS, there's crisis in education, even lawyers came out and campaigned against the Tory party policies. So more and more people, I think, will look to Jeremy Corbyn as a means of defending themselves, and I think people in power know this and quite fearful of it. I think even the press are worried about the fact that lots of people are seeing that they haven't been balanced. So there's been a lot of media coverage about how the media has been covering Corbyn and Corbyn's relationship to the media. And I think this reflects fear amongst the media that people, their ordinary readers, regard them as biased. I think that this arises more in the centre-left papers such as The Guardian and The Observer. And in the Observer on Sunday, the editor actually talked about how readers were unhappy with how they've covered Corbyn. So that the way the media is covering Corbyn is showing people that the media isn't as unbiased and objective as they'd like to make out they are.
Can you tell us whereabouts we can find you online?
I have got a my own WordPress website. I sometimes put across my ideas that contradicts the kind of media agenda that's been put across. I try and get evidence and come up with my analysis against the media.
So what's your own experience in the media? What's that been? I mean, you know, why do you feel that you the need to do something like that?
I've actually worked in the media. I was a journalist. I was a journalist for the Voice newspaper some time ago, and I have been working in PR, PR in central government and local government and other places. So I've got a sort of working interest in the media as well as any personal interest in the media.
Your blog?
My blog's called Simon's View, and the address is simongah.wordpress.com.
Simon GAH at wordpress.com. That's Simon Hines there. Now, perhaps you first, Steve. He's making some pretty incredible accusations there. And of course, what he's doing is he's pulling together mainstream news articles, really making a case for a serious investigation into postal voting fraud, which, surprise, surprise, the former Conservative Communities Secretary, Minister Eric Pickles, has been sent to investigate, whereas actually it's his own party that's being accused in many cases of fraud.
Yes, I think there's been problems with postal votes over many years, ever since the rules changed and people could have postal votes on request. Whereas before, you had to have a reason to have a postal vote, and so the numbers were much less, and so the scope for fraud was much less. We've had, for instance, the Birmingham case a few years ago, where postal vote fraud on a massive scale was uncovered, and that was actually aided by the old system of household registration, because the postal votes were sent to a different address. Now, there have been attempts to tighten that up over the years, and now with the postal votes you have the signature scan and so on. So I think I think it is better than it was, and attempts have been made to improve the mechanics of the system, but there are problems. I take issue with Simon in what he says about no evidence of a late swing. Certainly anecdotally, I know, talking to other Liberal Democrats in seats that were lost to the Conservatives, there are two factors I think that have largely gone unnoticed. One, that there was this huge fear factor about the Labour SNP thing, and they kept hammering that in the national media, but more significantly was on the back of that, the Conservatives did a lot of telephone polling to Lib Dem voters in Lib Dem Tory marginal seats to say, it's got to be us, you may not like us particularly, but, you know, we're going to be in hock to the dreadful SNP. So that fear factor was played on, particularly in the last 2 weeks. Now, that wouldn't have affected postal voters, because, of course, one of the issues with postal voters is they vote early. But I think it did have an effect on voters on the day. The other thing was a slight change in electoral law with regard to national spending, and that spending at constituency and indeed ward level in local government is quite strictly controlled as to how much you can actually spend on a campaign. National spending has national limits too, but it's the way national spending is done. And I think when it was set up, we envisaged national spending as being things like poster sites and that type of generic political advertising. One of the things the Tories have been very good at is actually doing target mailings from the Prime Minister, from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, to selected voters in marginal seats. And they don't have the number of foot soldiers that the Labour Party has in a lot of marginal seats. And in the Lib Dem Tory marginals, I think they had less foot soldiers than Lib Dems do. But certainly what they do have is much more money. And with much more money, you can do a lot of direct mailing and phoning.
Martin, the story quite clearly there about the 200,000 ballot papers which were stolen in the run-up to the May general election, and also the removal of the mayor of Tower Hamlets over voting fraud over several counts, actually. Ballots were double cast or cast from false addresses. False statements were made by Mr. Rahman. There was bribery, large amounts of money given to organisations who were ineligible to vote, treating people, providing free food and drink to encourage everyone to vote for this guy, and also voters were told it was their duty as a Muslim to vote for Mr. Rahman. But it's the postal vote problem which seems to be the key here to understanding, and there doesn't seem to be any real cross-party look at this. It's only Pickles and the Conservatives that are examining what's going on.
Well, I mean, allegations of individual voting fraud, like postal voting fraud, it's very hard to comment on because they're all individual cases. I'll just say this. There's overwhelming evidence that at least two presidential elections in the United States have been stolen. I'm referring to the first election of the Bush regime, if we can call it that, and even the second election of the Bush regime. Voting fraud and gerrymandering are absolutely normal practice in US politics, as is chucking masses of money from the wealthy at the contest. We are gradually becoming more like the United States. That's what happens. We buy in United States spin doctors or whatever to advise our political parties. And what goes on in the United States is pretty much corrupt. There's no doubt about it. And I think that we are going in that direction. I think also the first past the post system has become a joke. At the last election, UKIP, for example, got 4 million votes and one MP. Sinn Féin got 4.
Yeah, but what
that's
are we
not right.
Martin and Steve, what are we going to do about this? Because all this does is it makes people think, oh, there's no point in voting. The system's fixed. Martin.
Well, I think ultimately it will change. When Jeremy Corbyn came to Bristol, I put to him that he ought to actually be interested in reforming the electoral system. That is exactly what happened in New Zealand. The Labour Party in New Zealand split in the early 1980s because the Blairites, although they were called the Rogenomics
people. Okay, well, that's certainly not going to happen before the next election.
Well, no,
Steve.
It is possibly going to happen before the next election. It might happen before Christmas, Tony.
Steve.
I think it's a question of getting, you almost want to get the seesaw up. Both ends of the seesaw up at the same time. One of the problems is we did have a commitment from the Labour Party in 97 to implementing what was called the Jenkins Report, which was done by the late Roy Jenkins, and into an electoral system, and we would have ended up with something similar to what they have in Scotland. But that was never put forward. A lot in the Labour Party, I think they liked first past the post, because although it was unfair, they felt it might be unfair in their favour as much as it has been unfair in favour of the Tories. But historically, if you take the long view over 100 years, it's the party that's benefited from first past the post has generally been the Tories.
Okay, electoral reform then. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for that, as people have been doing for decades. Anyway, the army mutiny under Jeremy Corbyn. This was amazing, wasn't it? Both of your comments on this to begin with in the Sunday Times. It looks like Rebecca Brooks has just now become the editor of the Sunday Times. Now she's back at News International, because we had two fascinating stories last weekend, but probably the most important is this one about the serving general, Martin, saying that that there would be a mutiny of some sort if Jeremy Corbyn became Prime Minister.
Well, this is hardly news. I mean, the Wilson government faced down a concerted attempt by serving British Army officers to undermine the government of the day through the use of psychological warfare techniques in Clockwork Orange. And, of course, at one stage, the British Army even took over Heathrow Airport in a so-called anti-terrorist operation, which had no clearance from the Prime Minister's office. And that was quite clearly a message being sent to Wilson about what he could and couldn't do. Now, I just say to those generals who are talking like this, we've had a 30-year civil war in this country and the near assassination of two Tory prime ministers. You are playing with fire.
Steve?
Yeah, it's obviously outrageous that you hear these statements. I mean, I suppose it's good that they've leaked in a way, because at least that puts people alive to the danger that's there. But I mean, I'm reminded very much of a book that was written, I think it was by Chris Mullen, A Very British Coup, which was done in the 1990s. I think 1990s, no. Mm. It was about the 1980s, but I think it was written in the 1990s. And that actually presaged a lot of this. And yes, it's dangerous talk, and we've seen all over the world how the military can get involved in politics, and it's not something we want to see, obviously.
And the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Martin, has said that they will not share intelligence with Jeremy Corbyn, even if he's as Labour leader, because they don't trust him.
Well, I think this is becoming very clear. Now, if Jeremy Corbyn does become the Prime Minister, and look, we've got 5 years to go and possibly a world war and a crash to get through, so don't presume everything's going to stay the same. And if he does become Prime Minister, the obvious thing he's got to do straight away, which is what democratic politicians have to do in this situation, is sack everybody concerned. And, of course, prosecute those who are actually involved. I mean, I think that the people who took over Heathrow Airport without any instructions in the 1970s, they should have been sacked and prosecuted and sent to prison. Brigadier Gordon Kerr has been fingered by the British police and by investigations in Northern Ireland as running the Force Research Unit and being involved in hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland. Panorama programme about this not long ago. He should be put on trial and sent to prison for life, and life should mean life.
Yes, well, if you've got the BBC iPlayer, I would check out this week's interview with Crispin Blunt, the Tory chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, because he talks about this quite a lot under close questioning from Stephen Sacker. And let's have a little listen to an excerpt from that now, where he talks about the refugee crisis. This is to Tory MP Crispin Blunt.
Why has David Cameron steadfastly, adamantly refused to take any of the refugees, migrants, who are currently inside Europe?
Because it's the wrong policy. I think he's entirely right not to do so. The right policy is to apply resources in the region to look after people who are genuine refugees from the conflict in Syria. And the United Kingdom, by spending 0.7% of its GDP on the development budget, means that the United Kingdom has spent something like £1 billion supporting the looking after of refugees in Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey.
No, I understand that, but there is an immediate, urgent humanitarian crisis involving Syrian refugees inside Europe. You abandon those people, do you?
What has happened is that the conventions around the handling of refugees and economic migrants has collapsed, and people have not affected what was existing policy properly. And as a consequence, they are now left with this tidal wave of people coming who are being attracted by the fact that the European Union is not following the policies that are long established.
You've got all sorts of reasons why they're here, but the fact is they are here. And is it right that Britain refuses to help any of them?
Yes, it is, because Europe has got itself in this incredibly difficult position because it hasn't actually followed its own policies correctly. And had the European Union, had our partners in the European Union stood up to the plate as we have, contributed 0.7% of their GDP to international development, the whole international community and all the international agencies would have far more resources to look after these people in the countries immediately adjacent to the conflict, which is, after all, their first place of safety.
The Germans are appalled, frankly, at what the British are doing. Does that worry you, what this is doing for Britain's standing in Europe?
Well, there are two things going on here. There needs to be some hard European power to help the Americans and like-minded countries contribute to addressing the insecurity in the region. The Germans don't get anywhere near spending 2% of their GDP on defence. So they aren't making, in that sense, as indeed are nearly all our fellow European countries, not making a proper contribution to a
decent... while you make these arguments, strategic, long-term arguments, there are men, women and children on the verge of starvation, homeless, without any refuge, inside Europe, and Tory government in the UK refuses to help a single one of them.
Well, hold on a minute when you make those arguments. The government has committed to taking 20,000 people directly from...
Not these homeless people inside Europe. And over 5 years. There are more people arrived in Munich in 1 weekend than Britain will take over five years.
And if you put in place, if you continue to put in place incentives for people to do the wrong thing, which is to make this perilous journey out of the refugee camps, out of the region, or out of the region directly, out of Syria directly, if you're saying to people, you open the welcome signs in Germany, are you surprised there's this tidal wave of humanity trying to make this journey? And the people who are making that journey are, by and large, fit young men who think they're able to make the journey, and they're people with the resources to actually pay the traffickers to actually begin that journey and get it underway. The people who don't have the resources, the people who are really vulnerable, are the ones who are being looked after by the international community in the camps. And it is those people that the United Kingdom are going to try and help with the 20,000 who would then come to the United Kingdom.
That's Crispin Blunt there, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Steve, I wonder what you make of his analysis.
Typical sort of arrogant, aloof British nonsense, isn't it? I mean, this is what you come to expect from Conservative MPs. I was really pleased this week that Tim Farron at the Lib Dem conference made it very clear that we support a European approach to this, and we support cooperation and playing our part in the solution.
But we can't even house our own people, Steve, let alone migrants, refugees too.
Well, that's an issue of public policy, isn't it? This came up this week at the conference. You know, the whole question of building more housing. I mean, yeah, we have a desperate need to do that. Whether that's for indigenous population or whether that's for new arrivals. I mean, economically, it's been shown that we do need more people who are of employment age paying tax and national insurance to pay the costs of the increasing number of people like me who are not going to be economically active much longer. And I just feel that, Crispin Blunt talks about we need more hard European power, and I think that's been the problem, that we don't have that ability to get that sort of consensus, and it does need Europe acting together, and I think it needs the international community acting together as well. I think Turkey's made a suggestion that you have a safe haven within Syria with a no-fly zone and police that with an international force, probably UN troops. I think all these things need looking at.
Well, I can't agree with that. I mean, I've agreed with everything until you came to the last point. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record. He went on French TV about 2 years ago, said, when I was French foreign minister for Sarkozy, I was approached by British officials, and he stressed it was British officials, that said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Now, in actual fact, the evidence is overwhelming that NATO intelligence services and special forces have been arming and training jihadi terrorists inside Syria for many years.
Martin,
many
that's three
years.
Or 4 years ago that
yes,
happened.
And
what
that's
about
why,
now? How that's, do we deal with this?
Well, what you do, first of all, is we've got to deal with the immediate problem of refugees. The reason why they're coming from Turkey is that Turkey is a belligerent in Syria, and they have actually opened the camps in Turkey where they were quite happy to keep people for a time because they were trying to overthrow Assad, and they've actually pushed them towards the European Union in order to create more pressure for further hard intervention in Syria.
Okay,
the idea
why,
of putting,
why have these,
of putting an no fly zone,
camps, Martin, why have these camps been closed or opened up now?
Because the Turks, who were part of NATO and part of Britain's plan to overthrow Assad, has failed, and they don't know what to do now. There's 12 million people who've been internally displaced inside Syria or forced out. That's half the population, and that is a direct result of NATO intelligence services and special forces working with Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front and ISIS. The local people in the Middle East, the Iranian government, the Iraqi government, the Egyptian government know very well who's behind all of this. The Egyptian army arrested a number of jihadi terrorists inside Sinai about 3 or 4 weeks ago. They all turned out to be Turkish intelligence officers. Turkey is part of NATO. Their chaps are trained at Sandhurst. We are actually the terrorists that we claim to be fighting, and we have actually got to get to grips with this. We heard about the military in this country threatening to overthrow a future Labour government. Those fellows need to be dealt with.
Okay, finally, bestial necrophilia alleged in the Daily Mail. David Cameron at Oxford. Steve, 10 seconds on that.
I think the sad thing is that, people always can always say they did stupid things when they were 21 or whatever. I think the sad thing for me is that actually there's other things coming out in that book that are not seeing the light of day because of this rather amusing pig story. But there's a lot about the Cameron leadership or followership that is coming out of this book, and I think more will come up until the time when Cameron leaves office.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, former Eastfield councillor and ex-leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council, now heading off to Cyprus. Thanks very much for joining us, Steve Comer. After the